is Bad Boys and Beyond with your hosts, Mike Payton and Keith Black Trudeau.
That's it, baby, I'm foul.
Hey, I'll put it in the front page, back page, middle page, wherever headliners, column one or two, we will win game two. Good back it off, we will win game two.
The game's over and the Pistons have won the world championship.
Welcome back to Bad Boys and Beyond. We are your hosts, Mike Payton and Keith Black Trudeau. We say welcome back because Keith and I took a little sabbatical, maybe. I don't know. We took the holiday week off with New Year's and everything. Keith was apparently had no voice. Keith, you couldn't talk. Is this what you're saying?
Well, I couldn't talk for a brief amount of time, but it took a while for my actual voice to come back. So I sounded really, really raspy for about 3 or 4 days. It's a respiratory thing that's been going around pretty much the entire country. I'm sure most of the people listening to me right now can relate. I just wasn't in any physical condition. You would not have gotten the best out of me if we had recorded this a week ago.
No, I had it a few weeks ago too. And yeah, I know everybody's kind of getting sick right now. It's just that time of the year, but yeah, also, you know, I was incredibly busy, with NFL officiating and, you know, all these things that, just fighting the world off essentially along with the Detroit Lions. It was just one hell of a week. So yeah, we took the week off. We are back and we promise that we're not going to make a habit of going away from you for a while. We also promise you that we have a big show today. This is the Bill Laimbeer episode. I'm very excited about it. We have so many notes, so many great notes about this one. There's so much to talk about. I cannot wait to get into that. But first, we got to talk about something huge that happened in the interim while we were off. Something with the Pistons, something big happened. Isaiah Thomas had some trouble with Delta. I don't know what it is, but apparently Isaiah Thomas had some sort of problem with Delta Airlines. I don't know. That's obviously not what I want to talk about. What I want to talk about is the Pistons actually won a game. And Keith didn't think it was that fun, but the rest of the world had a blast.
Look, I thought the entire thing was embarrassing. Am I glad that the Pistons finally snapped their losing streak at a all-time record 28 games? Yes, I am. Because that meant that they would stop getting so much attention nationally, and people that hadn't watched them play for more than one or two games would stop pretending like they know what's going on or how deep the problems run with this organization, let alone the roster. But the night itself, you would hope that they at least would catch a Raptors team that had just traded their third best player that day. Just catch them not entirely motivated to play, which they sort of did to a degree, and just kind of blow them out and get an easy win, something entertaining for the fans. Really none of that happened. the Pistons shot the ball extremely well. Cade Cunningham played one of his best games that I've ever seen him play in his 3 years in the league. That's all great. The defense was still terrible. They had multiple chances to open up a big double-digit lead, and they couldn't really do that. I think the final 2 minutes, even though they were comfortably ahead for most of those final 2 minutes, I think the Raptors scored upwards of around 20 points because the Pistons were first too afraid to foul, so they were giving them easy shots, and then they were too reluctant to let them shoot, so then they started fouling them before they could even get shots off, which led to just this ridiculous exchange of free throws from both teams. And neither team was really missing free throws, so nobody accomplished anything. It was just a very ugly way to end a very ugly losing streak. And lo and behold, the very next game, they got blown out by 30 points in Houston. So who knows? A month from now, we may be talking about another long losing streak. I'm not sure. I am hoping and praying that a month from now, this is not the same roster of players, because this is just really, really hard to watch. I am sorry.
Do you know how embarrassing it would be to end a 20 plus game losing streak and then go on another 20 plus game losing streak. I really hope that doesn't happen. I'm
And
scared.
people,
I'm actually terrified.
I commented that this team is very capable of going on another 20, 25, 28 game losing streak. There's 50 games left in the season. They could do it. They are that bad. I'm half joking when I say it, but no, it's a real possibility. And I'm just hoping that at some point someone makes some kind of an effort to upgrade this roster and make it at least respectable. That at least that's all I'm hoping for from this point on. That is how low my expectations are. I just want them to get something together, make a trade, sign a player. I don't care who it is. I don't even care if they're 40 years old. I just want some players on this team that could help Cade Cunningham and Jaden Ivey and Jalen Duren. Because every time they come out of a game, it's just disgraceful how badly this team performs.
Kind of jumping off that a little bit, you know, I look, it's all been bad. It's all been really bad. But I will say, and I know you kind of ride the guy a little harder than everybody else does, but I've been very impressed with Cade Cunningham in the last 10 games or so. Like maybe with you know, Houston game withstanding, like he has been everything that you'd want him to be. He just needs help. He just really desperately, so badly needs help.
Yeah, I thought the last 2, 3 weeks he's played that it's been the best stretch of basketball. Like I said, the best stretch of basketball in his young career. And I hope that continues. He's cut the turnovers down a little bit last night, notwithstanding. He's shot the ball way more efficiently last night, notwithstanding. And look, he needs help, but look, Jaden Ivey's right there. Jaden Ivey, I think, is starting to play really, really good two-way basketball. Jalen Duren, really good. I don't think the young players are the problem here, at least not Duren, Ivy, and Kate Cunningham. The problem is that there's nothing around them. The veterans that are supposed to be showing them how to win are the ones dragging the team down. And that is really, really tough to take when you're talking about a team that has a young core that is supposed to be the foundation of your future, and they're having to sustain this incredible losing streak. That partially is not their fault. They're just sort of being left out on an island with no support. And I think that's the most frustrating thing for me is those guys have all played pretty damn well in the last month or so, and it hasn't really mattered.
Yeah, no, it's one more little thing here before, and we won't spend too much time on this, but before we get into Bill Laimbeer, you know, some players that everybody's trying to kind of shoehorn into the Pistons. I was curious what your thoughts are on, and quick
Okay.
thoughts, mind
All
you,
right,
quick
hit me.
thoughts. There's Pascal Siakam, obviously, is the top one everyone wants.
Okay, and he's going to be a free agent in 6 months. So as much as I think he would be a great fit on the Pistons, I think he's going to be 30 next year. Look, all things considered, the age thing doesn't bother me as much as if you can sign the guy, go ahead. And that's more of a off-season free agency thing for me because the Pistons can't justify trading anything of value for him right now because they could lose him in 3 months as a free agent, and they have no way to restrict his movement. So, if you want to sell to me that you're going to go after him as a free agent, fine. I'm okay with that. I think he'd be a great fit. But right now, unless you're trading expiring contracts and maybe a highly protected first in 2030. I wouldn't trade any of the young players or prospects on this team because you may not get any value for him outside of, 50 games of a lost season.
Tobias Harris return. I guess I don't really get this one. I mean, he's fine, but like, is that really gonna make a difference?
Tobias Harris didn't make a huge difference when he was here. It's not that he's a bad player, it's that he's just not good enough to affect winning and losing. Like he's a decent stretch four. He murders the Pistons, but that's because the Pistons are a very bad team that doesn't guard anybody, and they never guard the corners, which is Tobias's specialty. he's still not the best defender. He has a very strict ceiling on what he can do, and he's been one of the four or five most overpaid players in the NBA for the last 3 or 4 seasons. So I don't know. I know he has an expiring contract coming up, which once again says to me, at least, if you're not trading other expiring contracts for him of players that you don't want, why would you go after him in trade? Maybe as a free agent, but even then, I would have a very hard cap on how much I'd be willing to pay him because he's not a guy that's a difference maker. He's a role player.
And the final one, Miles Bridges. I think we both are very, very against this one.
Yeah, we don't. I don't even need to talk about him. I don't think he belongs playing professional basketball right now, and I'm just going to leave it at that.
No, totally agree.
I don't need to go on a self-righteous rant here about I would rather they move the team to Alaska, but look, it would disgust me to see him in a Pistons jersey, and we'll just leave it at that and move on.
Yep, totally agree. All right, let's go to California, and let's start off the Bill Laimbeer story. Unless you want to start in Illinois, or
I just want to just bask in the irony. Bill Laimbeer, to this day, is still the best NBA player born in the city of Boston, which he technically was. And I remind all my Boston followers on Twitter every year on Laimbeer's birthday, he is the best, still the best NBA player that was born in Boston. But he didn't stop there. He was the son of a fairly well-off executive, so they moved around the country a bit, living in the suburbs of whatever city they happened to be in. Didn't stop at Boston. Shortly after that, they moved to the suburbs of Chicago, where he grew up. And once he got old enough to play high school basketball, they moved to Palos Verde, which is not too far away from Los Angeles. So one of the greatest villains of the 80s spent all of his young years in Boston, Chicago, and Los Angeles. You just can't make that up. He didn't just have a stopover in Palos Verde. He actually led Palos Verde to the state championship. Bill Laimbeer is still considered to this day one of the best high school basketball players in the history of the state of California. He was an All-American. I don't think anyone really saw that coming from a guy that, he's real big, but not the best athlete, not the fleetest of foot. But he's always affected winning. And that's kind of where the legend starts with Bill Laimbeer. And that's probably the very last time he was ever the best player on his own team, at least on American soil.
Yeah, this guy's going to play for some incredible teams here, especially when we get to college. But one of the big things, though, is he becomes like somewhat of a TV star while he's in high school. The producers of The Land of the Lost, you might know the show if you're listening to this show, you probably are old enough to have seen Land of the Lost. And if you haven't, you've at least seen the movie with Will Ferrell, which I enjoy personally. But the producers of Land of the Lost were looking for some taller people to play Slee Slacks in the beginning of the
Lee
Slee Stacks.
Stackers.
Sorry, Slee Sacks, Slee Stack, Slee Stacks in the beginning of their run, and they went to Palos Verdes High School, and Bill Laimbeer was one of the people they chose, and he actually played a Slee Stack for 4 episodes of the show's first seasons, and that's episodes 1, 2. 4 and 6. So if you want to go back and watch them, you can you probably you won't be able to make them out. You won't be able to tell who's who which one is him, but you'll be able to say that you saw Bill Laimbeer on The Land of the Lost. You just got to figure out exactly which one is him. But that obviously won't be the end of Laimbeer's time on the silver screen. We'll get into some other stuff here later, but it's time to go to Notre Dame, which is a far away place from California.
Yeah, so Notre Dame, not a school that you would consider today to be traditionally a basketball blue blood. They of course have always been known for football, but not in the 1970s. In the mid to late 70s, still a good football program, but they were an unbelievably good basketball program. Don't have an NCAA championship to show for it, but it's not for lack of trying. Lambeer, he was a rotation player for Notre Dame almost immediately, but he never averaged 10 points or 10 rebounds. He was always a rotation player, but he was on an incredibly loaded Notre Dame team for pretty much his entire college career. His sophomore year, he flunked out of Notre Dame and had to re-enroll in community college, earn his way back in. So credit for that. But in the 3 years around that, he played with anywhere from four to seven other NBA players on his team, future NBA players. Guys like Adrian Dantley, Orlando Woolridge, Kelly Trpucka towards the end. Notre Dame, while he was there, they made multiple Sweet 16s. They made it all the way to the Final Four once, lost in the semis. But Lambeer's senior season, because he was on these stacked teams, he only averaged a little over 6 points and a little under six rebounds. For a college center, that is not anything that NBA scouts are going to drool over. So even though he did have tremendous size, 6'11", 250-something, extremely strong, very long arms, physically he fit the profile of an NBA center. Athletically, he did not. And certainly he did not have the traditional low post skills that most next level centers had at that time. So while he was drafted, if the draft were two rounds like today, he would not have been. He was a third round pick, 64th overall to the Cleveland Cavaliers in 1979.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. That, I mean, there's a lot of guys, I can't really think of any off the top of my head outside of Lambeer, but there's a lot of guys that if the draft was only two rounds, maybe never would have made it into the NBA.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy.
Well, I mean, we have a lot of undrafted free agents making it every year. So I don't necessarily know if that, how accurate that would, but yes, back then the undrafted free agents were the guys being drafted in the fifth, sixth, seventh round. It's kind of crazy that they had that many rounds for a league with only 20 teams, but they did. So, to correct myself, Lambeer was 65th overall, not 64th. I'm sorry.
It made some sense in the idea that, you know, like this, you're at least getting in front of an NBA team at that point. Like if you're an undrafted in the 80s and there was only two rounds, I mean, it's pretty hard to get in front of an NBA team. But if you're getting drafted in the sixth round, you're at least getting eyes on you.
That's a thing, because like many other draft picks outside of the first round, really being drafted, all that meant was you got a free training camp invite where they would take a look at you and decide whether or not they wanted you. That was kind of what it was. And it was that way in Lambeer's case, where he was given the option if he wanted to in 1979 to come to camp for the Cavs and try out, or he had an offer to play professional basketball in Italy for a substantially more amount of money, because back then European basketball was still in its infancy. They didn't have too many Americans, and the Americans that they could find got paid pretty handsomely. So Lambeer, having just got married, decided to take sort of a pseudo honeymoon and spend the first year of his marriage in Europe, which, hey, great, great decision for him. He goes to Italy, plays for, and I'm going to butcher this name, Pinti Inox Brescia. I'm sure I butchered that name, but that's the club he played for. Averaged 21 points, 12 rebounds. And Lambeer really credits that one developmental year in Italy as being the springboard to his NBA career, because he said he learned so much about himself as a star, getting as a number one option, having the freedom to discover what kind of a player he really was, and really build up his confidence. So when he comes back the following season, he tries out for the Cavs and not only makes it, but he is a starter right away his rookie season. Averages just shy of a double-double. Doesn't do too much, but you can see right away he is an NBA player.
Some really interesting things happening over there in Cleveland that are going to lead to some interesting things that happen in Detroit. Chuck Daly is his coach there. And
For his second season, yeah.
for the second season, and Laimbeer comes off the bench to who, Keith? Who's in front of him?
So, all right. So, this is, traditionally what all bad teams think when they're bad. It's because we don't have enough guys that score points. So, Cleveland goes out, they get James Edwards, who we have already covered on this show. Much more of an offensive player, certainly a much better low post player than Bill Laimbeer, a guy that can score points. So, Laimbeer goes from being a starter his rookie season to coming off the bench and being Edwards' backup his second season, averaging under 7 points and under six rebounds, only playing 18 minutes a game behind Edwards. The Cavs go from bad to absolutely horrible bad. And not too long after Bill Laimbeer is traded, Chuck Daly gets fired. It's just a big mess. But I think it's kind of ironic that Daly. Really didn't appreciate Laimbeer for who he was the first time he had him. Now, what is this trade we're talking about? So, Jack McCloskey, to this day, I still don't know if he was more interested in Kenny Carr or Bill Laimbeer, but he does make a deal. I mean, of course, for the rest of his life, he said, oh, yeah, of course I wanted Laimbeer. But so he orchestrates a trade with Cleveland. He trades Phil Hubbard, who was a starting power forward at the time, Paul McCaskey, who was a pretty decent backup center for his career, his first and second round picks in 1982. In exchange, the Cavs traded Detroit Kenny Carr, who was that was the headliner. He was the starter at the point at that point, put up some pretty good scoring numbers, and then also Bill Laimbeer. And really, none of the players or picks in this deal really amounted to much. I think McCaskey might have actually been the second best player in this deal. However, Bill Laimbeer, as soon as he steps foot in Detroit and teams with Isaiah Thomas, who was a rookie at that time, he was in the midst of his rookie season at that time. Laimbeer and Thomas were just a hand and glove fit, instant chemistry. Laimbeer moves into the starting lineup immediately in Detroit, starts all 30 games the rest of the season, averages just under 13 points, a little over 11 rebounds, shoots 51.6% from the floor, and averages 3.2 assists. Just a massive increase in production from what they were getting. And I think it's really weird because there was just no adjustment period needed. It was Laimbeer was such an intelligent basketball player, and he meshed so well with Isaiah Thomas. And I think this is a good point in time to talk about Laimbeer's skill set. Because Laimbeer, everyone understands the physical play, the little cheap shots, the elbows. He would get under your skin. That was his goal. It was never to start a fight. It was never to injure you to the point where you couldn't. It was to get you to react. It was to get you to think about how upset you were with him rather than playing the game of basketball. And he was very, very good at that. But that's not where his contributions end. Laimbeer was an incredibly skilled player for his time. Not just 6'11", 250. He had tremendous physical stature, long arms, defended really well. One of the best box-out players in the history of basketball, offensively or defensively, it didn't matter what side of the ball. He could seal a guy. He could seal two players behind him, and they would not budge until the ball came off the rim. He was an excellent rebounder, awesome outlet passer, very fundamentally sound. You almost never saw Laimbeer could go an entire game without the ball touching the floor. Ball was always shoulder height all the time because he could either shoot or he could throw dart passes. Overhead passes from that position. And he knew himself very well. He knew he wasn't a guy that was ever going to do a lot of ball handling. So the ball was always up high. And for that reason, he was usually a pretty turnover free player. Little guards really couldn't bother him because the ball was always 7 feet and a half in the air. And this brings me to my last point. Laimbeer was the very first stretch five, pure stretch five in NBA history. He was, of course, not the first center that could shoot. There was a lot of centers before him that had range. He wasn't even the first Piston center that had range. Bob Lanier famously had tremendous range, but he was the first center that was out there on the court, and his primary role was to hit perimeter shots and space the floor for everybody else. Today, almost every single team in the league has a player like that, has a center whose goal is to space the floor for everybody else and hit perimeter shots. Laimbeer was the very first guy in the history of the NBA, and I think that's an important fact that needs to be noted. Under all centers that played in the 80s, I think Jack Sigma is the only one that hit more three-pointers than Laimbeer. It's because he played a more minute. Jack Sigma was a star. He's a Hall of Famer. And lastly, and this is one thing that I don't think ever gets mentioned, one of the best free throw shooting big men of all time. If you look up the most accurate 6'11 and up players at the free throw line in NBA history that have played at least 400 games, Laimbeer ranks number six all time. Number six, behind Kevin Durant, who I don't believe is really 6'11, Dirk Nowitzki, Jack Sigma, Mike Jaminski, Karl Anthony Towns, and Bill Laimbeer. There's your list of the six greatest free throw shooting 6'11 and up players ever. He was just an incredibly skilled sharpshooter, and it kind of bothers me that we never got to see him play in the modern era where everyone's encouraged to shoot three pointers. I think Laimbeer would have loved it, even though he would have hated the less physical style of play.
Well, so he's going to show up in Detroit, as you mentioned, and then he is going to begin a incredible 685 yep. straight game streak of games. I mean, it's the longest streak to this day.
Well, in Pistons history, it is. Yeah,
it's not an NBA history because that's
no, Wikipedia. No. AC Green is over. Like AC Green is in like the thousands, I think.
Damn Wikipedia.
But it is the longest in Pistons history, of course. But yeah, he goes once he's traded to Detroit, he goes the next six seasons without missing a game. 82 games plus playoffs just about every single year.
That is incredibly hard to do. I mean, even though AC Green has more or whatever, but like 685, that doesn't happen today. Even if load management wasn't a thing, like it still wouldn't happen today. It's insane.
Yeah. Just for the record, AC Green played 1,192 consecutive games.
Yeah, but he like came off the bench for like at least 1,000 of those games.
No, he was a starter for most of his career.
In L.A.?
But yeah, L.A. Not L.A. in Vancouver. And Phoenix and Dallas. And yeah, he had a lot of stopovers. But look, you're not going to get an argument for me. Laimbeer's physical style of play, he had to play through a lot more punishment than AC Green did, of course. I'm just stating a fact. That's all I'm doing.
Well, he doesn't only just start that long streak. After the 82 season, the Detroit Pistons go out and find a new coach. And what do you know? It's the guy that he just left. Chuck Daly yep. is hired as the Pistons coach in 1983.
Yep. So, and at this point, by the way, I think we should point out Laimbeer is already an all-star. His first season in Detroit, 82-83, averages just under 14 points, a little over 12 rebounds, shoots 50% from the floor, makes his first of four all-star games. He was just not, like, calling him a role player is probably accurate, but so is the fact that he was a four-time all-star. Once Chuck Daly comes aboard, the Pistons start to win games finally at a pretty good pace. I think they win 49 hit their first season. Laimbeer averages 17.3 points, 12.2 rebounds, ups that in the playoffs. His second playoff game ever is probably statistically his best. Has 31 points, 15 rebounds in game two against the Knicks. Also, I has a very memorable thunder dunk over Bill Cartwright, which still warms my heart to this day. But also one thing that happens that season in 83, 84. Bob Lanier, who I've mentioned already, he comes to Detroit in his farewell season as a member of the Milwaukee Bucks, and Laimbeer is just frustrating the hell out of him and just annoying him to no end. And Bob Lanier, poor Bob Lanier, just loses it and hauls off and punches Bill Laimbeer, just sucker punches him square in the face, breaks his nose. I don't know how he didn't break his facial bones, because it was a square punch from a very, very strong human being. Of course, Lanier gets ejected, he gets fined, and for the first time in his life, he is soundly booed in Detroit, Bob Lanier. He cannot believe it. That yeah, it's just a vicious shot right to the face. We're looking at the video right now. It's on YouTube.
Yeah, I've never seen it before, so I YouTubed it. Yes, that's a shot. That's a real shot to the face right there.
Yep. I don't remember if it was Lam if it was Lanier's final game in Detroit. I don't think it was. I think maybe he had one more, but yeah. It turned, because the fans in Detroit were already so in love with Laimbeer, it actually turned them against Bob Lanier, who was, in my opinion, the greatest center the Pistons have ever had. It was just this really weird moment. But it wouldn't be the last, of course. It'd be far from the last of list of altercations of Bill's career.
Oh, for sure.
So,
Besides getting his face broke, by the way, he
and
doesn't
he
miss a
and by
game.
the way,
He
yeah,
doesn't miss a
he
game.
keeps playing. Yeah, he puts on a mask and he keeps playing, with his nose smashed in. Nothing would, no, I don't, no injury was going to stop this man from showing up to work the next day. I just think that's so neat.
It's a competitive spirit, man. Like some people, you know, this is their life. This is all they want, is to just be competitive. And I can't think of anybody that's more competitive than Bill Laimbeer.
And the weird thing is, I don't really know if Bill Laimbeer ever truly loved the game of basketball. Like guys that would play for free, like, or at least they say they would. I don't know if it was ever a thing, a basketball thing with Bill, or if it was just he loved to compete, and he was a professional that loved to do his that enjoyed showing up to work and giving his best every day at work. That may have been it for me. Because I'm really, I don't know if I've ever seen the guy smile like more than like half a dozen times in his entire Pistons career. He was just stone-faced, intense, just about every game.
He also makes the All-Star game again here in '84, despite Bob Lanier breaking his face.
Yeah. Has really maybe his best playoff series individually, averages 19 and 11 against Buck Williams and the New Jersey Nets in the first round. Pistons finally get out of the first round with a sweep. Not so lucky against the Celtics, the defending champion Celtics, in the next round. But yeah, Bill Laimbeer at this point has put together back-to-back-to-back All-Star appearances, which I don't think people today realize that he had that many All-Star appearances. And the weird thing is, the very next year he breaks his streak. He doesn't make the All-Star game. But he still averages 16 and a half and 13.1 rebounds. He leads the entire league in rebounding that season, despite not even being an all-star.
Yeah, that's insane. I was looking at that. He makes the All-Star game 80, 83, 84, 85,
Yeah.
then has arguably his best season in 86,
Yeah.
but doesn't make
It,
the All-Star game.
well, I, the reason for that is because the Pistons struggled. For most of the first half of that season, they were teetering to being falling out of the playoff race, and so you weren't going to give the Pistons more than one all-star, and Isaiah was obviously going to be the first guy selected. I don't think it was because of his numbers. It's just, oh, not only that, you had Patrick Ewing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got to remember that. That was Ewing's rookie year. They were,
He was
they,
huge.
yeah, but
And
he didn't.
he.
You know, he wouldn't have been factored in because he didn't. He was injured. He wouldn't have been able to play in that All-Star game. So I don't even remember who his replacement was.
Robert Parrish,
Yeah,
Moses
would I
Malone
think?
also made it in there.
Yeah. So who knows?
Oh, it says right here, Jordan and Ewing weren't replaced by anyone.
Oh, there you go. So in modern times, he would have been replaced.
So there you go.
Maybe by a little beer. Who knows?
Well, we did miss over, one thing, his maybe his best career regular season game in 85 against the Cavs, 35 points in a win over his former team.
Yeah. I mean, everybody was lighting up the Cavs in 1985. But yeah, I think it is kind of interesting that, yeah, he seemed to have a special place in his heart for torturing the Cleveland Cavaliers.
Well,
So,
87.
but yeah, 87, he follows it up with his final All-Star appearance. He's back on the team, 15 and a half points, a little under 12 rebounds. And his numbers start to dip here, but that's because I think he has spent at this point 3 or 4 seasons, what, 83, 4, 5, 6, 7. So 4 seasons, the first 4 full seasons of his Pistons career, he was very easily the second best player on the team after Isaiah. Now, he wasn't the second leading scorer, Trepucca was, or sometimes Trepucca was actually the leading scorer. But the point is, the most important player, the guy that was controlling the backboards, the guy that was the one guy in that team that at that point that was bringing a lot of physicality, a lot of intimidation, it Laimbeer. Laimbeer was Isaiah was clearly the most important player, but Laimbeer was like 1B right behind him. Hence all the All-Star appearances. So as the Pistons start accumulating talent, where they trade for Adrian Dantley, they get Dennis Rodman, John Salley, James Edwards, they draft Joe Dumars. All of a sudden, Laimbeer's spot in the pecking order is starting to go down as the talent level is raising up. So by the time 87 and 88, yeah, Laimbeer's hitting 30, but he's also now the third best player on the team after Dantley. And, a year later, he's probably going to be the fourth best player after Rodman, or excuse me, after Joe Dumars. And then Rodman's going to start coming of age. So it's really interesting how, as the Pistons start winning at a championship level clip, Laimbeer's recognition goes down. And I think that's a little unfair to him because he was always the type of player that made everyone else around him better. It's just that he wasn't touching the ball as much as he used to. That's really the only difference.
Well, he is going to unfortunately end his 685 total game streak in 1988 after a fight with Cavs center Brad Doherty, of all things,
89.
to 80, excuse me, 89 rather,
It was, yeah, it was during their championship season.
of all things to end a suspension was that fight. Like, no one could even remember that one. You would think it'd be the fight with Barkley or the fight with some anybody else, but like, I don't remember him fighting with Brad Doherty.
So the Pistons and Cavs, and Isaiah hinted at this a little bit when he was on our show. The Cavs were the up and coming team in 1989. I don't want to say the Pistons were old news, but they were the new hot thing in the NBA, and they were in the same division as the Pistons, and they had beaten the Pistons their first three meetings. At that point, they had a better record than the Pistons. So the one thing the Pistons had over that Cavs team was experience, and it was kind of Bill Laimbeer kind of took it upon himself, and Rick Mahorn did too, to try to get a mental edge and intimidate the Cavs, and that worked to a degree. But it all comes to a head in January 27th, 1989. He gets into a fight with Brad Doherty, and the league disciplinarian, I think Rod Thorne maybe at that time, said enough was enough and suspended him for one game. And that broke his streak, which was the thing that maybe he was most proudest of in his entire career.
Yep, and it's really unfortunate. Just, and again, like a fight that no one even remembers. Was it even that bad? Have you seen this fight? Were there punches thrown, or was it just
Oh yeah,
bad?
no, there were punches. I'm trying to remember it right now, but yeah, there were definitely punches thrown. Again, this was a hotly contested divisional game in Cleveland. The Cavs still wound up winning. I think it was the last time that they actually beat the Pistons that season. But yeah, It was a I don't remember what started it, but I do remember, yeah, it was a fist fight between Laimbeer and Brad Doherty, who was the center on the Cavs at that time. And look, to that point, getting into fights just meant you had to pay a fine to the league. And at that point, that was when they started saying, okay, well, fines aren't going to work. We're going to start taking game checks away from you or prevent you from playing for your team. And at that point, I don't think it really changed the way Laimbeer approached the game. I do think it really pissed him off and turned him kind of into more of a villain than he was before.
Well, you know who the Cavs really should have hated was the Bulls, because the Bulls knocked them out of the playoffs the year before and then did it again this year in 89. And yeah, I mean, I think like Jordan just owned the Cavs and like loved doing it. But 89 is going to be a big year for obviously for Bill Laimbeer and the Pistons, especially when it comes to the playoffs. Tell us about it. Tell us about the playoffs.
Well, first, I'd like to tell you about the Mark Aguirre trade, the famous one for Dantley that was made mid-season. Bill Laimbeer, very noted opponent of that deal, because he knew, despite Dantley's faults, he knew Dantley. He knew Dantley would show up and go to war during playoff time, and he wasn't quite sure about Mark Aguirre, who he had never seen or heard anything to indicate that he'd be able to succeed on the Pistons. So, very first day of practice, he pulls Mark Aguirre over in front of everybody and says, "Look, I don't know you. I've never heard anything good about you. But here, you're going to. I don't care if you miss 15 shots in a row. If I get beat and you're not there to help me, I'm going to start yelling at Chuck Daly to get you out of the game." You're going to be if you're going to be here, you're going to be playing defense. We don't need all the scoring, and that's a thing that's been well documented that actually happened. That he kind of got in Aguirre's face almost immediately, first day of practice, to get him on board and to get him up to speed on how the Detroit Pistons do business. And that was kind of the thing that set the tone for, they went 30-4 at one point for the rest of the season. That was a well-oiled machine. And look, Laimbeer didn't have any great moments in 89. Not many of the Pistons did because it was so easy for them relative to, their other playoff experiences. But yeah, that was Laimbeer did well. But it was more of an ensemble thing where his numbers don't look great. I'm pretty sure he was the leading rebounder in the team that year only because Rodman was coming off the bench. But they do win their first championship. But I think the second one is really like the shining moment of Bill Laimbeer's career, that 1990 season, or most notably the finals.
Well, let's talk about it. Let's just get right to it. Well, the Pistons head back to the playoffs in 1990 and obviously go to the finals. And how did Bill Laimbeer affect that Blazers team?
All right. It's interesting that this starts off in a game that the Pistons actually lose. The one finals game in that series they lose was game two. Laimbeer hits 6 3-pointers, which at that time was a finals record in game two. The Pistons still wound up losing just through a series of they just didn't have it mentally to defend the Blazers in that game, and the Blazers were on fire. So both of those teams, and understand the Pistons hadn't won in Portland at that point in 16 or 17 years, I want to say. And both teams were undefeated at the playoffs, in the playoffs at that point. Both teams thrived on winning their home games. And Chuck Daly's on the team bus. They're getting ready to go to Portland, and he's trying to sell his team on, let's just, if we just win one, we're going to come back to the Palace for game 6 and 7. And Laimbeer, as the story goes, stands up and says, "Screw it, let's win all three of these." And that's kind of, well, I mean, that's exactly what happened, as we know. But I don't think people appreciate what Laimbeer's influence was on that series. Portland, yeah, they get their offense from their guards, Porter and Drexler, but they also have a couple of all-star big men in Kevin Duckworth and Terry, excuse me, Buck Williams. Two very, very good players, very good rebounders. Duckworth, excellent low post scorer. Buck Williams is just the God's definition of power forward. I could go on and on forever, but those two guys were just as important to the Blazers as Porter and Drexler, and Laimbeer just took it upon himself to take them out of the game. Just frustrated the hell out of them, baited them into silly fouls, baited them into offensive fouls. Game three, Laimbeer, Duckworth and Buck Williams combined for 7 turnovers and 11 fouls in game three. Bill Laimbeer has 11 points, 12 rebounds himself, and fouls out at the end of the game. The game's already over. The Pistons have dominated. And the Portland fans are cheering. It's one of the greatest Bill Laimbeer shots ever, where the Blazer fans are all cheering because Bill Laimbeer has fouled out. They've announced he's heading to the bench. And Laimbeer's is literally, he's treating it like a curtain call. He's taking a bow as he's going towards the bench. It was just the perfect moment of victory for him. He just played the role of villain in that series just as well as I've ever seen anyone do it. And it didn't stop at game three. Game four, Kevin Duckworth and Buck Williams combined 6 of 15 shooting and another 6 fouls. Laimbeer out-rebounded them by himself, and he out-rebounded them again by himself in game five. 17-13. And from that point on, Portland mentally had been taken out of the series. There was so much, and there's audio of Rick Adelman pleading with his players, Portland Trailblazers coach Rick Adelman, pleading with them to stop whining about Bill Laimbeer, stop focusing on Bill Laimbeer, and just play. And it was too late by that point. Isaiah very well deserved the MVP of that series because he was fantastic, but man, it would have been so nice to see Bill Laimbeer get that finals MVP trophy. It would have been so fitting.
Just for being the biggest jerk on the floor.
It's not just, again, he owned the glass in those three games. He played his role to perfection. But it was just the mental games that he played with the Blazers. It was just the perfect. It was the perfect three game sequence for him. He put on the black hat. He embraced the villain role. He dominated where he could skill wise. But more than that, he took several of Portland's most important players. He took them completely out of the series. Just mentally, they were more focused on him, and it completely threw them off. And these are all-star caliber players. These aren't just nobodies. That's just how good Laimbeer was at agitating people.
Yeah, he gets 15, 11, 12, 12, and 17 rebounds. Those are his rebound totals for those five games. It's pretty good. He also fouls out in two of those games, but I mean,
yep.
It is what it is. Speaking of fouling out, and this is my moment, Keith.
Okay.
I'm really excited about it.
Age is yours.
Bill Laimbeer doesn't like fouls, and he gets his own video game in 1991 for Super Nintendo called Bill Laimbeer's Combat Basketball. Oh, wait a minute. He's got a finger.
Can I just preface this with the fact that earlier in the year, he was on the cover of Sports Illustrated for their NBA preview edition with the caption, it's an exasperated look of Bill Laimbeer's face with the caption, pardon me, Mr. Referee, I'd like to ask a question. What foul? Like this was like the year of Bill Laimbeer. I don't understand why.
He had a lot going on this year.
He did.
But the basketball game is called Bill Laimbeer's Combat Basketball. Now, here's how it worked, Keith. Have you played this game?
I am very sorry to say that I have, yes.
Okay, yeah.
I rented it. I don't remember once or twice. I do remember playing it. I never owned it, but I do recall renting it at least once or twice.
Yes, this was during a time when like basketball players started to have their own video games. There was Bill Laimbeer's Combat Basketball, there was Shaq Fu, there was Charles Barkley's Shut Up and Jam, there's Michael Jordan's Windy City Blunder, which is really not even basketball related at all. You actually play Michael Jordan trying to save the rest of the Bulls from something. I can't remember what it was.
Well, no, yeah, but it was he fights using basketballs though, like hot and cold basketballs. Like there are basketballs involved, but yeah,
Yes,
these are all terrible games.
you throw
They are
basketballs at
all,
bad guys.
yeah, they're all games. And look, Bill Laimbeer's Combat Basketball came out for the Super Nintendo, as you said, November 1991, from a third party called Hudson Soft. Which they actually put out some pretty good stuff. This is definitely one of their low points. But here's the thing: when you play this game, it does not feel like a basketball game at all. It feels like a soccer game that they reprogrammed, painted over just to make it look like a basketball game because someone had an idea.
Well, here's the premise of the game, real
Okay.
quick. We're in the future of 2031, which is not too far from where we're sitting right now.
Six years from now, this is our future.
Bill Laimbeer, who will be in his 70s in 2031. He's the commissioner of basketball of the basketball league. Doesn't say NBA. He's just the commissioner of the basketball league. He's fired all the referees and he's created a style of play that has no rules. There are no fouls and you can use weapons. And furthermore, your players wear armors and you can throw mines onto the court. And it's a real interesting game for sure.
It sells it as something way more important than it is. Like, this isn't the first basketball game to experiment with making all fouls legal. Arch Rivals did that years before this. So that was kind of my selling point to me was, hey, this is a on the brand spanking new Super Nintendo. This is going to look awesome. Think of all the things they can do with this. And it really isn't. All of the violence and the mines and stuff are kind of off to the side. They're rare. It's hard to get them involved. The fact that pushing and shoving people, again, Arch Rivals did this years before. But I think the lamest thing is that first of all, there are rules, all right? Out of bounds, as you will well recognize. Because the ball goes out of bounds constantly because there's only one button for every action in the game. Passing, shooting, dribbling, jumping, everything. It's all one button. For the six button Nintendo, Super Nintendo controller, it only uses one button to play this game. So basically what you're doing is you are throwing the ball. You are either throwing the ball to a teammate or throwing the ball at the basket. There is no sense of verticality. That's why when I say it feels like a soccer game, it doesn't feel like the ball goes up. It's either you're throwing the ball at a teammate or throwing the ball at the basket. There's no real shooting mechanic. And I think what's kind of dumber is when you're inbounding the ball, you're dribbling. It is such a weirdly stupid thing that they couldn't even get that right. When you're inbounding the ball from the sideline, the player is always dribbling it, which makes me think that this was originally a soccer game that someone just deep. Yeah, it is incredibly hard to score. I think I've scored one basket in 2 hours because, again, there's no shoot mechanic. So you're basically trying to aim a pass right at the basket. And God forbid you miss the basket, the ball's going to sail right out of bounds. Because you're essentially passing it out of bounds. Two-thirds of this game is spent with the ball out of bounds and you inbounding it. It is a very, very frustratingly ugly game to play. It doesn't look that bad. I don't recall the soundtrack being that bad, but it is the worst designed basketball game I have ever seen in my life, and I will stand by that. I'll also note the trapezoid lanes. So apparently FIBA has taken over basketball in the year 2030.
yep, that's how it's, I mean, with With the amount of European players that are coming into the NBA right now, it wouldn't
Yeah,
be a shock if FIBA takes
just
over.
the fact that they made a basketball game with
Yeah.
no one jumps, I think that's just incredibly hilarious. You created a basketball game where nobody jumps.
I
Or at
can't
least
think.
I don't think I've recall seeing anybody jump in that game.
I
It
can't really.
just
Well, you
it's
can't
a
really.
soccer game that they tried to paint over and make it look like basketball. That's the only way I can explain it.
Right. Well, you can't really see anybody jump because you're watching this game, you're playing this game from an overhead view.
Yeah, it's a
Whereas
bird's eye
most,
view. I'm sorry for everybody. Yeah, it is a bird's eye view. You were looking down at the court the entire time, which would, again, if you're playing a soccer game, that makes sense. A basketball game, it makes very little sense because you don't get a sense of verticality of seeing the ball in the air. The ball just gets a little bit bigger or a little bit smaller to let you know that it's dribbling. And by the way, when you are dribbling, the multicolored ball is spinning sideways. I don't know how physics works in this universe, but
20, 30
the ball
meters.
is always spinning sideways. Whether you're shooting or dribbling, oh God, I could pick this game apart for hours. But yeah, it is absolutely terrible.
Yes, it is regarded as one of the worst games ever made. I mean, it's right up there with ET for the Atari. Only they didn't bury this one in the desert. Maybe they should have. The next thing that he does in 1991, besides playing basketball, is he is in the movie Hot Shots. You may remember, you may not. Charlie Sheen was actually a big star at one point in time in our world. You wouldn't know that today, especially after the whole meltdown that he had. But he was a huge star, was in a lot of movies, and Hot Shots was a takeoff of Top Gun and some of the 80s war movies. But anyways,
It was a spoof.
there's a spoof. There's a fight scene in which Charlie Sheen and Cary Elwes are fighting in a bar, and then everyone in the bar starts fighting. And then for some reason, it flashes to Bill Laimbeer and Charles Barkley in a corner, like choking each other. And it only lasts for like 10 seconds, and then it ends. But it's hilarious because you don't expect to just suddenly see Charles Barkley and Bill Laimbeer fighting each other. But interesting cameo in that movie. Is there any more basketball you'd like to talk?
Well, I mean, he had that scene in Forget Paris with
Oh
Billy
yes.
Crystal, you know, where
I've
Billy
never.
Crystal plays a referee and ejects him from a game, along with about half the other players on the Pistons and the Lakers. It's a great scene.
The best part of that though is when he ejects Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Kareem says, "This is my farewell game," and Billy says, "Well, let me be the first to say farewell." Good stuff.
So yeah,
Billy Crystal.
Laimbeer's villainy gives him a little bit of celebrity because the Pistons are, well, at least at this point they were champions. But of course, as we all know, the Bad Boys had a very ugly end. Players left, didn't get really replaced by anybody, any prospects of note. So the team went downhill very quickly. Everything comes to a head. Bill Laimbeer's final season of 93-94. The team is losing. They really don't have any chance of even being a playoff team. Laimbeer sets an extremely hard screen on Isaiah in practice, and Isaiah loses it and punches him in the face and breaks his hand. And Laimbeer, they're both suspended. Well, Laimbeer comes off his suspension, and he said it was the first time in his life he'd ever been afraid of being booed, because he was afraid that the next time he played at the Palace, his own fans would boo him. For Isaiah breaking his hand. So he has this wonderful Renaissance game. His first home game back, comes off the bench, doesn't even play the first quarter, has 26 points and 7 rebounds against the young gun Shaq. Well, I don't think Penny played in that game. I know Shaq did. The young gun Orlando Magic frustrates the hell out of Shaq defensively, shoots 11 from 15 from the floor. And by the end of the game, fans gave him a standing ovation. He played so well. He was hitting shots off the dribble. He was doing stuff that he never even tried when he was in his prime. And this is older, you know, out of shape, literal 10 days from retirement, Bill Laimbeer. Just puts together a one last like masterclass performance about everything that made him great. And a couple weeks later, towards the end of November, he retired. 11 games into that season, decided that he didn't want to stick around for it. He didn't have any desire to play. He wanted to just leave on his own terms, and he did that. And you can call it abandoning your team, but that to me, that team was headed nowhere anyway. And I think he left everybody with a great moment to remember him by. Even though I'm one of the few people that remembers that moment, I thought it was great.
You know, the thing I find interesting is they retired his jersey almost immediately in the
Oh yeah.
1995 season. Like, it happened fast.
Yeah.
That doesn't always happen.
Yeah, I think
Sometimes.
they retired his. I don't remember if they retired his jersey first or Bill Laimbeer's. I could have sworn it was Isaiah's first.
It would have had to have been.
Well, I know they retired Isaiah's in '96. That's why I'm trying to remember when they
Oh.
retired Bill's.
Bills was 95.
Okay, so then they did retire Bill's first.
Okay, interesting. Well, after his stint with the Pistons, very long, successful stint with the Pistons, he's retired now. He moves on to do some color commentating for the Pistons. You might remember him in the early 2000s. I don't. I lived in Memphis at the time.
So, yeah, so I guess a lot of people wouldn't remember this unless you were old enough to be around at that time. But once Kelly Trepiuka, who was George Blaha's TV partner during most of the 90s, he was his color commentary guy. He left to go back home to New York to be a commentator for the Nets. And all of a sudden, a spot opened up. And Bill Laimbeer was George Blaha's broadcast partner for, I want to say, 3 or 4 seasons until Fox Sports Detroit bought up all the rights and Greg Kelcer replaced him. But yeah, I thought Bill Laimbeer was great doing color commentary for the Pistons. I thought he might have been my favorite color commentary guy, all due respect to Greg Kelcer, that I've seen in my life for the Pistons. He was really good at that job. And he was so good, he actually moonlighted on ESPN as one of their network analysts during halftimes of games. Now, he wasn't quite as good at that because he kind of leaned too hard into the villainy part of it, where he would just love to throw it in people's faces that, I'm a Detroit Piston. I'm going to be biased towards the Pistons. I mean, he was open about it and honest about it, but that didn't make people like him anymore. But yeah, I thought he was very good on TV. And but I think more importantly was around that time he took over the Detroit Shock, and the Detroit Shock WNBA franchise, they were the worst WNBA franchise by far. They were plagued by bad players, bad picks, a scandal here and there, some allegations that I won't get into. It was an ugly situation. No one wanted to see the games. And Laimbeer comes in, takes over as the coach and GM, just straightens everything out immediately. And I mean immediately. They went from, I think they were the very first team in the history of American professional sports to be dead last in their league, and then the next year have the best record in their league and win the championship. That's how quick the turnaround was. Now he got more talent in there. He got the owner to spend more money to acquire that talent. But the bottom line is, he turned that Detroit Shock team into a reflection of himself and who the Bad Boys were, where they were very physical, they owned the glass, they intimidated, but they were a very fundamentally sound team above all of that. And that showed just almost, it turned me into a Detroit Shock fan overnight. I know that much. All of a sudden, the Detroit Shock were appointment TV for me during the summertime. Because that was such a they played so differently from every other women's team at that time, where they were getting into fights just about every other week. It was he reincarnated the Bad Boys into a women's team, and I will forever love him for that. It was just the greatest time with the Detroit Shock, and I would argue that there is an argument for Bill Laimbeer to be a Hall of Fame coach, simply on for what he did with the Detroit Shock, winning 3 championships, for a franchise that never had any support. And as soon as he left, they shipped them out of town to Tulsa because Bill Laimbeer was the Detroit Shock. He was the face of that entire thing. I think he deserves to be recognized for that.
Yeah, and he even brought his buddy Mahorn in on the coaching staff as
At the
well,
very, very
at the
end,
very end. Yeah,
yeah.
but three championships, coach of the year. He also had a stint with the New York Liberty and the Las Vegas Aces. Actually, that was pretty recently. He led them to the WWNB Finals, WNBA Finals in 2020, before retiring from coaching. But as far as coaching in the NBA, it's something that he very openly wanted to do, but it never really happened. He did get an assistant coaching job with the Timberwolves from 2009 to 2012. There were some rumors, and maybe it's just rumors, that Isaiah Thomas maybe wanted to bring him in as the coach of the Knicks at one point, and Joe Dumars considered bringing him in as the coach of the Pistons after Larry Brown went to New York.
Yeah.
But those are just rumors, I guess.
So yeah, he did get an assistant gig with the Timberwolves, which I keep hearing didn't go well. I don't know why it didn't go well. I just heard that his job as an assistant in Minnesota kind of cost him any consideration for head coaching opportunities. I don't know why. I do know that he was kind of a victim of the player empowerment era was just starting around the time he was getting into coaching in the NBA, and there was a lot of fear I know among teams that Bill Laimbeer's abrasive coaching style he can get away with it in the WNBA where the players don't really have a lot of power and don't make a lot of money, but they didn't think that his abrasive brand of coaching would work with the fragile egos of young 20-something NBA superstars that are used to being coddled, which my answer to that is look at how Greg Popovich, treats his has treated his players for decades. He doesn't mince words. He's hard on them, but he also shows them how to win games. Maybe not this year, but he shows them how to win games. You can't tell me that Bill Laimbeer couldn't have coached, at least with the opportunity in the NBA. I understand why no one hired him, but I think that those worries were a bit overblown. I think if Laimbeer were a little bit younger, I think maybe he would get a shot today. I think 15, 20 years ago, I think everyone was a little bit too scared of players running everything. Now I think it's more acceptable to hire a more hardline coach.
Was Kevin McHale with the Timberwolves when he hired, or what, did he hire Bill
I do
Laimbeer?
not believe so.
I don't. Okay, he wasn't. No, never mind. You're
No.
right.
I think that might have been David Kahn, actually.
Yeah, it was David Kahn, but
Yeah.
that would have certainly been interesting if that would have happened. Oh, there was one more Hollywood thing that I noticed. And speaking of Kevin McHale. Kevin McHale was on an episode of Cheers, and for whatever reason, he was handed an X-ray of a gorilla's head, and he said, "Oh, that looks like Laimbeer." So there's another. I mean, Bill Laimbeer was incredibly famous in the 80s and 90s. He should be in the Hall of Fame. It's just insane to me that he's not.
I think he will be eventually, but I think that he's one of those players that needs a little bit more distance between him and his playing days. I know it's ridiculous because it's been 30 years since he retired, but I still think people think a little bit too much of him as a villain now, even now as opposed to a really skilled basketball player. I think at some point it'll sink in that he probably deserves to be in, but I don't think it's right now.
You know, something just hit me when you said that. The last time the Detroit Lions won a division title, Bill Laimbeer still played for the Pistons.
Yep.
Well, actually, that's not
Well,
true because the
I'm going to
last
say it's
time,
not true
that's not
anymore.
true anymore. Yeah. Well, that's gonna do it for the Bill Laimbeer episode. Keith, what are we doing next week? You want to do the 2021 draft?
Yep. I think it's time.
All right, we're gonna do the 2021 draft, and we'll see. I know what I'm going to do if I had the number one pick. I'd I don't think
Well,
there's
you don't
any.
have the number one pick. I have the number one pick.
Oh God, Keith, if you take Evan Mobley, I will just cancel this podcast immediately. But all right, we'll see what happens next week. The 2021 NBA draft. See you then.